The headlines: Russia warns the United States that a possible seizing of its asset would mean the end of bilateral relations. The U.S. says it will continue to fly and sail around the Taiwan Strait, apart from working on a roadmap for extensive trade with Taipei. And the U.S. Justice Department says FBI agents took top-secret files during a recent raid on former President Donald Trump's Florida residence. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Russia warns the United States over seizing its assets, saying that the possible measure will permanently damage bilateral ties. The warning was made by head of the North American Department at the Russian Foreign Ministry, Alexander Dachev. He said that the damage in Moscow-Washington relations will be in the interests of neither side. The Russian official also referred to what he described as the increasing U.S. influence on Ukraine. He said the U.S. is now becoming a direct party in the Ukraine conflict. Tensions have remained high between Moscow and Washington ever since the Russians began the war in Ukraine. Washington has led the West pressure campaign against Moscow. The United States has a pledge to boost trade with Taiwan despite tensions with China over its growing ties with the island. Washington will unveil a new trade plan and conduct air and maritime transits through the Taiwan Strait within days. That, according to the White House coordinator for Asia-Pacific issues. Kirk Campbell says the U.S. is responding to what he called China's provocative behavior on Taiwan. He accused China of using the recent Taiwan visit by the U.S. House Speaker as a pretext of trying to change the island's status quo. Taipei has hailed Washington's new pledges, saying China's intimidation has strengthened the unity of the global democratic camp. China claims Taiwan as its own territory and has repeatedly warned against the island's growing ties with Washington. Tensions have been escalating since House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan earlier this month. FBI agents have found top-secret documents during a raid on the residence of former U.S. President Donald Trump. The Justice Department says 11 sets of classified documents, including top-secret files, were removed from Trump's Florida home. The department also says that the former president is believed to have violated a federal law that bans the possession of national defense information. Media reports say these are secret files on U.S. nuclear weapons. Trump, however, rejects this. He has called the search a political retribution, claiming that he had no stored classified information. The FBI is yet to make a comment amid criticism of the move by leading Republicans. This is the first time that the property of a former president has been searched as part of a criminal probe. Salman Rushdie, the author of an anti-Islam book, has been attacked on stage at an event in the U.S. state of New York. A man stabbed the blasphemous novelist in the neck and the abdomen when he was about to give a lecture. Rushdie is now on a ventilator, and his agent says he has suffered damage to his liver and one eye. The suspected attacker has been detained. Police, however, say they have no indication of a motive.
We don't have any indication of a motive at this time, but we are working with the FBI, the sheriff's office, and we will determine what the cause of this was or what the motive for this attack was.
Police have identified the attacker as 24-year-old Hadi Matar from New Jersey. They are assuming he acted alone. Rushdie published his blasphemous novel, The Satanic Verses, in the late 80s. The novel triggered an outcry across the Muslim world. Political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas says Salman Rushdie was a tool in the hands of the West to confront Islam.
On an individual level, he'd kind of outlived his usefulness. I guess Rushdie takes the inauspicious honor or denigration of being, the first potential tool of Western neoliberal deep state in that process of its war on Islam, the real Islam which talks about justice and talks about governments which should be just and talks about a system which is, you know, anti-usurious perhaps, anti-corruption, anti-exploitation of the masses.
An Iranian-flagged tanker seized by Greece in April is now reloading its oil shipment to return to Iran. Iran's embassy in Athens broke the news, adding that Lana tanker will soon depart for the country. The development comes after the Greek Supreme Court canceled an earlier order for seizure of the consignment. The ship was earlier detained by Greek authorities and its oil cargo was confiscated by the United States in late July. It triggered tensions with Tehran, which called Athens' move an act of robbery. Iran has also detained two Greek tankers for violations in the Persian Gulf waters. The Iranian president says his administration will not tie the country's problems and progress to sanctions or their removal. Ebrahim Raisi says the progress and economy of the country won't be kept back on account of other people's smiles and scowls. He vowed that the growth and development would continue forcefully despite the enemy's threats and sanctions. The Iranian president stressed that the Islamic Republic has never abandoned the negotiation table. He was referring to diplomatic efforts to revive the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA. The agreement was left hanging by a thread after the unilateral U.S. withdrawal from it in 2018 and the reimposition of sanctions on Iran. The Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu has revealed that back in October last year, he held talks with his Syrian counterpart Faisal Maqdad. During the talks, the top Turkish diplomat said the Syrian crisis would be resolved if Damascus holds talks with opposition groups. Rajan Saklam reports.
Turkey's Foreign Minister Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu says he had a side talk with Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad on the sidelines of the Non-Aligned Movement Summit in October last year. The Turkish minister added he suggested a reconciliation to take a place between the Syrian government and the opposition, noting that without such a step, Syria will continue to face a crisis. Çavuşoğlu said that the EU and the international community would support a ceasefire in the war-torn country, and that no country would help in Syria's rebuilding process if a ceasefire is not achieved.
To prevent the division of Syria, there must be a strong administration in Syria. The will that can dominate every corner of its lands can only be achieved through unity and solidarity. We need to bring the opposition and government together for reconciliation. There will be no permanent peace otherwise.
Some believe such a revelation is a signal indicating Turkey is preparing for its cross-border military operation in northern Syria. In recent weeks, the Turkish army has been sending reinforcements to northern Syria, near the town of Tel Rifat. The town is under the control of Kurdish YPG forces, a U.S.-backed militia that Turkey considers the armed wing of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as PKK. Some analysts believe Turkey has long been serving its own agenda in Syria. For example, by supporting some opposition groups inside Syria who served Ankara's interest in securing its borders and pushing Kurdish forces back. It might be soon to say whether Ankara has changed its strategy in regards with Syria. What is clear for Turkey is that fighting or defeating the Kurdish militants cannot guarantee its security. Rajan Saklam, Istanbul.
Britain's economy is flattering. It contracted by 0.1% in the 3 months to June, with a recession predicted at the end of this year. We discussed this issue with our correspondent and a guest in the latest edition of our news review program. Welcome to this edition of the News Review. In this edition, Britain's economy has become smaller amid a cost of living crisis and high inflation at its highest in decades. The Office for National Statistics says a gross domestic product dropped 0.1% in the second quarter this year. The office blames the contraction on a fall in services output, mainly from health and social work activities. Last week, the Bank of England said it expects the economy to enter recession in the fourth quarter. The recession would be the largest since the 2008 financial crisis and is expected to last for a year. Just recently, the Bank of England raised interest rates by the biggest margin in nearly three decades. It did so to ride out the inflation, mainly caused by soaring energy and fuel prices. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent in London, Amina Taylor, and also from London, Rodney Shakespeare, professor of economics. Let's begin with our correspondent, Amina. If you could please tell us more about this new report about Britain's economy that has shrunk.
Well, there's just more bad news for consumers and those of us living in the United Kingdom right now, because even though the Office for National Statistics say that, you know, there would be a recession in the fourth quarter, I think for many of us in real terms, that period has already started. If you think about how our pockets are and the money is coming into our bank accounts and what's going out. If you're looking at not just the Bank of England putting up the interest rate by the largest margin, as you pointed out there, in three decades, it's now at 1.75. It was as low as 0.1 just a few years ago. So you look at that jump and what it means in real terms. People who are on fixed-term mortgages, people like myself, who will have to now address how they will pay for those increases come that period when they are off those rates that they were locked into for a little while. Then you look at the inflation rates. That's hovering at 9.4. And again, in real terms, that would be higher. If you look at the consumer price index and how much that's gone up by, you know, the cost of items in your bread baskets and so on, that would have gone up more than the 9.4%. That's the official figure. So all around, it's been terrible news for British consumers. And some of the reasonings that they've pointed out as to why that is, well, it's simply not just stacking up here. Because if you're talking about, you know, inflationary pressures being driven by the crisis in Ukraine and so on, well, that can be addressed. If you're looking at other stimuli, well, a lot of those can also be addressed by governance. And we have a prime minister and a chancellor of the exchequer who just up until a few days ago were on holiday. We have the two front runners in the leadership campaign who are talking about, you know, pie in the sky economics at the moment, especially in the case of Liz Truss. The situation is not being managed. Some of the reasons it's caused were, you know, you could have seen them coming. And it's the most vulnerable who are going to continue to bear the brunt, I'm afraid.
Okay, so Mr. Shakespeare, we just heard our correspondent Amina explaining what the situation is like. What is the way out of this recession that is facing the UK?
The two candidates for the leadership of the Conservative Party and therefore to be Prime Minister talk about anything except the major cause of the key component of the inflation, which is these rocketing energy prices, which are going into inflation. And to get rid of them, to moderate them, you simply have to say, well, why have they suddenly gone up like this? And the answer is, of course, it's the consequences of the war in Ukraine. And the war in Ukraine is a consequence of 25 years of Western policy moving NATO nearer and nearer to Russia until we get to a point where the Russians say, you've gone too far, thus far and no further. Though there was an agreement, the Minsk agreements, which would have stopped the trouble in Ukraine. And it was Ukraine, backed by France, Germany, the UK and America, which deliberately broke those agreements. So let Truss and Sunak, two right clowns, let them address the major cause of what is now a social calamity coming in the UK. The average fuel bills would be about £4,200 a house. And Amina mentioned mortgage rates. Well, with the inflation as it is, they're going to be forced to raise mortgage rates even further. And there will be a complete social disaster. So I'm afraid they're not even thinking about the true cause of this. Behind this is this endless push by NATO to expand and to expand and to expand.
Thank you very much. We're running out of time. Amina Taylor, our correspondent from London, also from London, professor of economics, Rodney Shakespeare. Thanks to both of you for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review. And thanks to all of you for following us. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The Leader's Viewpoint on Imam Hussein's Revolution and Ashura. If this battle had not taken place in Karbala, we would not be aware of the principles of Islam to the extent we are today. And there was probably just a nominal trace of Islam. Not only were this great event and the holy blood of the martyrs not undermined, but they also gained more prominence in history. This is an outstanding example. Everyone was wondering what had happened on the day of Ashura, the greatness of the event, the greatness of the jihad done by the Prophet's loved one and his companions was not known to anyone. Neither was the magnitude of the catastrophe in which the Holy Prophet's sons and loved ones were martyred. The majority of those who were present in the battle did not recognize the importance of this issue. And those who were fighting for the enemies were so ignorant and unaware that they did not realize what had happened. Those enchanted by ignorance, lust, and animal urges cannot understand what is happening in the human world. Of course, Sayyidah Zainab Salamullah Alayha Sukaina. And those innocent girls and women did recognize the magnitude of the event. This is what happened on the day of Ashura.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
the story didn't just end in the afternoon of Ashura. In fact, since the afternoon of Ashura, a movement has started in history, which is still growing and expanding. It will be the same in the future too. Imam Hussein alayhi salam did all in his power to proclaim the word of truth and to save the people. These are some of the traits that a person in general can see and show in the Ashura event. Some events are forgotten over time, like a weak wave created by throwing a pebble in a pool of water. There is a wave, but as the time passes, it becomes weaker every moment and fades away in a short time. But there are events the other way around. They do not fade away over time. Rather, time makes them more important. One example is the event of Ashura. Those who are not familiar with Islam, but understand the concepts of freedom, justice, dignity, elevation, and lofty human values, consider Imam Hussein alayhi salam as the imam in seeking freedom, in seeking justice, and the fight against viciousness and against ignorance and human degradation.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
French President Emmanuel Macron recently said he wanted a review of his country's military policies on the African continent and had asked his ministers and army chiefs to work on it.
J'ai demandé au ministre et au chef.
I have asked the Defense Minister, Sébastien Lecornu, and the Joint Chief of Staff to rethink by next autumn the entirety of our military presence in Africa.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and it's always great welcoming you here at Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative analysis of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on efforts by France to reboot its diminishing neo-colonial influence in Africa. By pursuing such a policy, France is clearly ignoring the voices of most Africans who want to see an end to the negative influence of former colonial powers in the continent. The second part of our program will be on a new report showing that African governments owe three times more debt to Western private lenders than to China, and are charged double the interest. So stay tuned till the end of our show today.
France rebooting neo-colonialism in Africa. French President Emmanuel Macron said last month that he wanted a rethink of all his country's military postures on the African continent by the first half of 2023. The operational overhaul is said to have an impact notably on the country's involvement in the Sahel region. The remarks by Macron were followed by a visit to three African countries in what is seen as deliberate efforts by Paris to strengthen, revive, and rejuvenate its imperialism in Africa. Despite the efforts by Macron, France is still perceived negatively in Africa.
In May this year, demonstrators from the South African Economic Freedom Fighters Party marched to the French embassy in Pretoria and demanded that France should leave Africa. Party leader Julius Malema said French colonialism in Africa is the most Brutal. Let's take a listen.
French colonialism in the African continent continues to be the most brutal, cruel, and devilish form of colonialism in the African continent. We, as a generation of freedom fighters, reject and condemn the fact that decades after the declaration of so-called independence of former colonized territories, colonizers continue to maintain a colonial and neo-colonial relationship with African countries which are supposed to be free from colonial control.
Well, for more on how France is reshaping its neo-colonial strategies in Africa, we have contacted Nestor Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, President Emmanuel Macron of France wants a rethink of all of his country's military posters on the African continent, and he even asked his ministers and army chiefs to work on it. What's your take on this statement?
Mm-hmm. So it's a necessary reconsideration that they have to make because of the crisis of imperialism and the fact that neocolonialism is on its last leg in the continent of Africa, particularly in the African neo-colonies. When we think about Mali in particular and just all of the Burkina Faso, all of these different places where France's military footprint is not being seen favorably by the masses of the people, and naturally so, then they and imperialism, not just France, but all of them have nothing else to offer. No other means of enforcing their hegemony, but through militarization and militarism, then they have to rethink what are they going to do. So they, you know, they've already been kicked out of Mali and have to withdraw their troops from there. And so right now they're in a waning position.
In recent years, protests against the presence of France in its former African colonies have been on the rise, particularly in West African countries such as Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, and Chad. Last year, French troops on their way to central Mali from Burkina Faso killed two such protesters in a Nigerian town. A Malian activist says they are opposed to French imperialism and control in the region.
Nous ne sommes pas contre la France, nous ne sommes pas contre les Français, mais oui, nous sommes contre la politique française au Mali, nous sommes contre la politique française au Sahel.
There have been protests against the French military in several West African countries, as you earlier mentioned. So why is France insisting on imposing itself on Africa while ignoring popular opinion in the continent?
All of the current and what we call neocolonial powers have to ignore popular opinion. It is natural because popular opinion leads to and is tied to the natural inherent aspirations of self-determination. And self-determination is antithetical to neocolonialism and neocolonial interests. So neocolonialism exists to extract and the wealth and the resources to impose its markets and, you know, its economy, control the economies. And all of that is the exploitation of Africa, which is, you know, people don't want that. And so popular opinion is really an expression, no matter how, you know, essentially speaking, when we boil it down, is an expression of the desire to self-determination.
French President Emmanuel Macron's trip to West Africa last month was touted by Paris as his latest effort to reshape France's relations with its former colonies in Africa. But the visit's short-term fanfare is unlikely to halt deepening opposition to France or slow down its declining influence in the region. The continued plundering of Africa is critical for the survival of Western economies.
They're trying to find ways to address this irreversible economic crisis of imperialism. And then right now we're seeing in a world where the tensions are high, particularly like with the NATO war against Russia, that it's making extremes in terms of even Europe is facing shortages of goods and the disruption of the trade routes and things like that, oil and all that. And so right now they have to look to, and then they also are concerned, also they're concerned about Russia's and China's relationship on the African continent. So right now, their objectives have to be, and they know that they can't, that militarism is not faring well. So they have to figure out and search for other means to sustain their interests and their hegemony in this area.
Niger, the world's poorest country, according to the UN's Human Development Index, is increasingly becoming a center of Western military expansionism in Africa. Although Niger regained independence from France in 1960, the former colonial power still plunders the country's rich natural resources. Now, France's foreign and military ministers recently visited Niger, a key partner of Paris in the Sahel. What is the role of this uranium-rich country in France's renewed neocolonial push in Africa?
They participate in this military exercise, the African Lion, it's called. It's a very joint military exercise with all these different countries, Western countries and African countries, trying to, in their so-called interest to combat terrorism and extreme, these violent insurgents, as they refer to them, although they really should be seen as that themselves, because they don't really bring the stability to the continent of Africa. So Niger is still in a position to, at least the elite of it, because the masses of the people in none of these countries really want the presence of these former colonial powers and these current neocolonial powers. So they're seeing Niger as a partner and trying to beef up this, what their so-called war against terrorism, and then also trying to figure out how they place themselves strategically in Africa, where their influence is waning. Influence waning all the way up to the state level, and for example, in Mali, the state itself.
During his visit to Cameroon, French President Emmanuel Macron denounced what he claimed was hypocrisy expressed by African countries regarding Russia's military operation in Ukraine.
The choice that has been made by the Europeans, firstly, is in no way to participate in this war, but to recognize it and to name it. I've seen too much hypocrisy, particularly on the African continent, and I'm saying this very calmly, with some not calling it a war when it is one, and saying they don't know who started it because they are diplomatic pressures.
These remarks by Macron are not surprising, as they further reveal his neo-colonial and patronizing attitude towards the people of Africa.
And my last question. Now, will France succeed in re-establishing its waning influence in Africa, especially in view of competition from other powers such as Russia, China, and Turkey?
Even if they were to get some reestablished, to gain back some influence, we have to be mindful. I think one of the things that would be inform us is the insightful and seminal work of Kwame Nkrumah, that neocolonialism is the last stage of imperialism. There is no other stage, for imperialism to have in terms of maintaining itself. And so an imperialism is in a state of crisis. Imperialism meaning the dominance and the hegemony of these Western powers over the economies, political life, and even culture of the places. People are no longer going to stand for it. It's exposed to be the existential threat that it is to the masses of the people, at least on the continent of Africa, and it's getting so other places. And so it can't reestablish it. It can only maybe get a little bit of its control back, but that's only a temporary thing.
Well, there you have it. Neocolonialism is the last stage of imperialism, and the masses in Africa are resolute in reasserting their independence. Thanks a lot, Nefta Freeman, for your in-depth analysis. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is on how private Western lenders are increasing the debt burden in Africa.
African debt burden blamed on Western lenders.
You're listening to Africa Today.
Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
According to a report released recently by a UK-based charity, Debt Justice, African governments owe three times more debt to Western private lenders than to China and are charged double the interest.
Citing calculations based on World Bank data, the report said that just 12% of African governments' external debt is owed to Chinese lenders, compared to 35% owed to Western private lenders.
Now, African experts say that the debt trap narrative propagated against China is part of a wider geopolitical rivalry between West and China.
The debt trap issue has always been a political, slander. A third of African debt is owed to asset managers, private banks, and all that. But interestingly, the West has loudmouthed. The monopoly of global media means they could shout from the rooftops and get everybody listening.
Now, to discuss how private Western lenders have chained Africa to a heavy debt burden, we have contacted Lawrence Freeman, a political economic analyst for Africa. Thanks for joining us today, sir.
Great to be with you.
Now, the report released by the UK-based charity Debt Justice in July confirmed that Western private lenders are hugely responsible for Africa's debt burden and not China. Now, this is seldom in the mainstream media, and all we hear is the so-called China debt trap. Now, is there a conspiracy of silence here?
What we've seen over the last several years is that there's been just simply propaganda, outright lying, saying that China now is the biggest debtor, that the African countries have China as the biggest lender, and therefore they also have put forth this theory that China is deliberately indebting African nations above the means in which they can pay the debt, and then they would, the Chinese, presumably, when the Africans defaulted, they would take over these projects or actually their physical resources. And of course, none of this is true. Debt trap diplomacy doesn't exist. It's a propaganda lie by the West to attack China.
Tim Jones, head of policy at Debt Justice, says the UK and the US should rein in on private Western lenders because most international private debt contracts are made under British or US law. He adds that Western governments have failed to take on companies in their own countries who, unlike China, did not suspend debt repayments during the pandemic.
75% of the African economy is driven by the middle-income countries. Now, these are the countries that are having a challenge with the question of debt. So unless you recognize that without dealing with the pressure that countries like Egypt, Kenya, South Africa, Ghana are facing, that you'll not be doing much in terms of saying that you are helping the African economy.
Why are Western governments failing to compel private lenders to ease loan repayments from low-income countries to tackle a debt crisis?
You have to understand that for increasingly over the last half century, the United States and the West, but I know the United States the best, has moved away from any concern about actually developing and assisting and collaborating with African nations and other third world nations to develop their economies. They will not, as a matter of policy, they will not help countries actually economically develop. they're not interested in the kind of long-term low-interest loans that African nations would need to build infrastructure. So they don't want low-interest loans. They don't want to make long-term investments. They allow the private sector to make quick buck overnight, big returns, and they could care less about what it takes to build up an economy and raise the standard of living of people.
China, unlike most Western countries, supports Africa in making infrastructure development a priority for economic revitalization. It encourages and supports Chinese enterprises to adopt various models to participate in the construction, investment, operation, and management of infrastructure projects in Africa. The Kenyan president elaborates here.
Partnership with China is not a partnership based on China telling us what we need. It is a partnership of friends working together to meet Kenya's social economic agenda.
At the end of 2020, Western private creditors held $247 billion in debt from African countries, compared to $83 billion for China, $274 billion for multilateral institutions, and $93 billion for other public creditors. Africa continues to receive colossal amounts of money from Western lenders, yet many countries in the continent are still wallowing in poverty.
Most of them go to quick, high-return investments. Over the years, most of these investments have been in the extractive industries of oil and gas, and they have obviously not gone into actual development. The United States and the West, for the bulk of the last several decades, has been investing in extraction, even though they attacked China for this. And it's mainly oil and gas. And they look for investments where they don't have to actually make any long-term commitment. What Africa needs, what all developing nations need, all nations actually need, is they need to develop and expand their infrastructure. Infrastructure is the platform of which an economy grows and develops.
The G7 countries have acknowledged that there is need for debt restructuring at a meeting last June. Now, leaders said that they will urge all relevant creditors, including private creditors, to get more involved in debt restructuring. An official of the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa says many African countries are in need of debt relief.
ECA is calling for debt suspension, debt services suspension. So far, only 32 African countries benefited from debt suspension by the IMF of a total of $9.3 billion. And we are arguing for more debt suspension, services suspension, and we are also arguing for on-lending of SDR, special drawing rights, so that African countries can have more access to international resources.
Western powers claim to champion for the rights of African countries, yet interest rates charged by their financial institutions for African loans are well above those of Chinese lenders. Now, what's your take on this?
This so-called concern for rights of Africans and African nations is really a false democracy. In other words, they don't really thinking about how to develop a nation. How do you make a democratic nation? How does a nation become democratic? The people have to be involved in making the decisions for the future of their country. Well, they can't do that if they live in poverty. And the West's so-called concern for human rights and democracy and other issues like this are, again, propaganda. The right to live, the right to have food, the right to have housing, the right to have a job, what Roosevelt once called the four freedoms. This is what is required, and the West has no concern. So when the West talks about, the United States talks about the rights of African nations, it is pure hypocrisy.
Despite promising signs of a continuing global economic recovery in 2022, the African debt situation is of great concern to many people in this continent, which has immense untapped potential. Now, how can Africa get itself out of this vicious cycle of high interest loans by Western lenders.
I have been advocating for many, many years, and I put out articles constantly on my website, Lawrence Freeman, Africa and the World.com. I call myself a follower of Alexander Hamilton. I refer to myself as a physical economist. And what we need is Hamiltonian banks where the capital of the bank is lent out on a preferred low interest basis for those investments in infrastructure and industry that will help the nation grow. I have now been working with a group for a couple of years of Africans to establish a African Infrastructure Development Bank, which would be a bank that whose purpose would be to lend money for infrastructure. Now we have to get a capital base for the bank, and then we lend out a portion of that. Infrastructure is the most essential element for building up an economy. And an infrastructure bank would be the most important type of institution.
Well, Africa needs a special bank for infrastructure development to disentangle itself from the current debt burden. That's the opinion of our guest, Lawrence Freeman. And I would like to thank him for his incisive analysis today. And that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. It was great having you. Thanks a lot, and goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. We've been in the studio. We have very special guest speakers for today's discussion, Sheikh Murtaza Karimi, an Islamic expert from the Islamic Hawza of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to your show.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the authenticity of Ziyara Nahya al-Muqaddasa. We can roughly translate this, the title of this Ziyara, as the Ziyara of the Sacred Person. We can say this is a Ziyara related to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, which is recited especially on the day of Ashura and other occasions. So give us some details about Ziyaratul Nahya al-Muqaddasa. What is this Ziyara?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. An-Nahiyat al-Muqaddasa is a term which was used by the Shia from the time of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam to refer to the Imam of the time. Mm-hmm. And in this case, we are talking about Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. And This Ziyara Nahiyat al-Muqaddasa is narrated by one of the special deputies of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So it's a visiting text
For
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam issued by Imam Mahdi. Alayhi salam and may Allah.
So, sorry, Nahiya Muqaddasa means coming from a holy person.
No, Nahiya means...
I translate as a sacred person.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, An-Nahiya al-Muqaddasa is referring to Imam al-Mahdi alayhi
Imam
salam
al-Mahdi.
Himself. And Ziyara Nahiya Muqaddasa means The text which is issued for visiting the Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And this text is coming from An-Nahiyya al-Muqaddasa, who is Imam Mahdi alayhi
salam. Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
There are two ziyaras which are known as Ziyara Nahiyya. One of them is famous and the other one is not that famous.
Okay.
The one which is not which is famous, as I mentioned, is quoted by one of the special deputies of the Imam. And this ziyara has been quoted by Sheikh al-Mufid and also in Bahar al-Anwar, in Al-Mazar al-Kabir, in As-Sahifat al-Hadiya, and some other famous Shia collections of prayers. The other one is Ziyarat al-Shuhada, and that is different from the Ziyarat that today we are talking about. Some people also call it Ziyarat Nahiyya Muqaddasa, but this is a Ziyarat given to us by a person called Muhammad bin Ghalib Isfahani. And in this Ziyarat, we read about the names of 80 companions of the Imam, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, and those who killed him, those who killed them. And it seemed that this ziyara is from Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, or for Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, not from Imam Mahdi.
Okay.
So the question is about the famous one, yes. Of course.
So that's all right. What about the authenticity of this ziyara? I mean, is it referred to and does it have many references during the history or not?
The oldest source that contained this ziyara, Ziyara Nahiyya Muqaddasa, is Al-Mazar al-Kabir, by Ibn al-Mashari, who passed away in 595 after Hijrah. And now, still today, it's a matter of dispute, not only for Ziyara Muqaddasa, but for Al-Mazar al-Kabir by Ibn al-Mashari, whether it is an authentic source or not. We're not talking about the source now, we're talking about this Ziyara. The Ziyara does not include and contain the chain of the narration. He says that Ibn al-Mashhadi, in the beginning of his work, explicitly mentions that all the ziyarat that I'm quoting in this book, I have received them through complete chain of the narration, but for brevity, I'm omitting the chain of the narration. Okay. So, and that is the problem, if we may put it this way, for later scholars to trust Ibn al-Mashhadi in his claim or not.
Okay.
Now, we have... the majority of the scholars agree that, I mean, he's a trustworthy person and all these ziyarat can be called, I mean, true ziyarat. But we have some scholars, for example, Ayatollah Khoui, rahmatullah alayhi, he believes that he himself, Ibn al-Mashhadi, he is an unknown person to us.
Uh-huh.
So we cannot rely on him.
That's
and
right.
Among contemporary Shia scholars, we have some people who believe that this ziyara cannot be accepted because of some issues, especially in the chain of the narration. But the majority of the Shia scholars believe that, first of all, Ibn al-Mashhadi himself is a great scholar. He is a trustworthy scholar. And they have accepted the authenticity of the book Al-Mazar al-Kabir.
Okay.
For example, we may refer to Shahid Awal, the first martyr, Sheikh Al-Amali, Allama Majlisi, Sheikh Abbas Qummi, Sayyid Muhsin Amin, and Aqbadok Tehrani.
That's all right. What is the main content of this ziyara text, Sheikh?
This ziyara begins by sending peace and greetings to all the prophets and Ahlul Bayt alayhimu salam, like by saying Assalamu ala Adam asafatullah, sending salam upon all the prophets, beginning from Adam alayhi salam. Then it talks about what happened, the kind of description of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam before the tragedy of Karbala, what caused this tragedy to happen, how Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was martyred himself.
Mm-hmm.
It talks about the companions of the Imam, and also it talks about the mourning of all the creatures for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And finally, it has some tawassul, some supplications and prayers.
That's right.
Now, if I have time, I may go to some more details about the authenticity of this ziyara. Now, the point is that, first of all, Allama Majlisi in Bihar al-Anwar has quoted this ziyara in different volumes, and he has mentioned that Sheikh al-Mufid, he has quoted this ziyara in his book Al-Mazar as one of the recommended deeds for the day of Ashura. So this is one point by Allama Majlisi which considers this ziyara as, authentic ziyara for the Imam.
Thank you.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Now, as I mentioned regarding the chain of the narration, there is a kind of difference of ideas among Shia scholars, but the majority of the scholars, of Shia scholars, they have accepted Al-Mazar al-Kabir by Ibn al-Mashhadi. But the second point is that, because we are talking about a ziyara text, we are not talking about jurisprudence. Yes. When it comes to Islamic laws, it's very important for you to check all the chain of the narration one by one.
Yes.
But when it comes to recommended deeds like du'as, supplications, prayers, and ziyarat, it's been proved that it's not the case for us to check one by one all the narrators, because in that case we may refer to the content.
Yes.
Because in many cases the content of a supplication and a ziyarah tells us that no one but an infallible imam can issue such and tell us and recite such a supplication. So imagine, for example, we have no complete chain of the narration for Dua Abu Hamda Thumali.
Yes.
Or Dua Kumail. Yes. Or Dua Harafa. Is it possible for a fallible person, a person other than Imam, to issue such a great Dua and Ziyarah with all these profound content?
Yes.
According to many scholars, this is one of the ways through which we can come to this conclusion whether it is an authentic text, authentic supplication or not. So when it comes to Ziyarah Nahya Muqaddasa, many scholars believe that the content of the narration is telling us that no one but an infallible imam has been able to say all these profound contents. The next point is that this ziyarah has been quoted by many great scholars that I mentioned. This is another qarina, another indication that if it was not an authentic text for visiting Imam Hussein alayhi salam, so the Shia scholars shouldn't have quoted this ziyarah in their books.
That's right.
I mentioned the names of some of these great scholars. Later we have other scholars, for example, Sayyidina Taghut in Misbah al-Za'ir, as I mentioned, Allama Majlisi in Bihar al-Anbar, Ibrahim bin Fayyid Kashani, and many others, many other scholars, they have quoted this ziyarah in their books.
We can read it on any day, but especially on the day of Ashura.
Yeah, okay. It's been one of the ziyarah which is specific for the day of Ashura, but it doesn't mean that we are not able to recite it on other ways. Regarding the great and high content of this ziyarah, let me quote a story from Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Kashif al-Qita. He was asked about another supplication which is known as Dua al-Sabah. And he was asked whether this Dua has an authentic chain of the narration or not. And in his answer to this question, he said that we know the words of the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt, especially the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. It's not possible for any person other than Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam to have said and to have issued this dua. In that case, he was talking about dua al-sabah.
Yes.
So this is the point. As I mentioned, even if you do not accept the chain of the narration, there are some indications, a bunch of evidence which tell us that this ziyarah cannot be issued by any person other than Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. So many scholars believe that, ziyarah Nahiyya Muqaddasa is an authentic ziyarah for, visiting Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And either the chain is authentic because of the fact that Ibn al-Mashhadi himself says that I have quoted all these ziyarat,
yes,
through a full chain of narration. If we accept that from Ibn al-Mashhadi, then it's okay. Otherwise, if we reject this claim,